Now on News Talk, as part of our winter season of documentary on News Talk, producer Brendan Daly charts the extraordinary story of Ireland's first surfer, Joe Roddy, in Surfing at the Crossroads.
Nice morning.
Not bad. Are you
falling? Oh, I am,
The village of Port Magee in County Kerry is the main departure point for a rocky island about 7 miles into the Atlantic Ocean. About 10 boats are docked at the pier in Port Magee. They are about to ferry passengers to Skellig Michael, a medieval monastic settlement that survived for over 500 years. Today, I'm travelling to this early Christian outpost with Joe Roddy. Standing at about 5'8", Joe is sprightly and has distinguished features. It's hard to believe that Joe has just entered his 9th decade. Joe is a boatman who's been ferrying passengers to Skellig Michael for over 50 years. But that's not why I'm here today. The seeds of a surfing culture were planted in Ireland in the mid-1960s.
A bushy blonde hairdo, surfing USA.
Kevin Cavey formed the first surf club in Bray in 1965, and the first Irish National Surfing Championships took place in Tramore in 1967. But to find the person who built and stood on the first surfboard in Ireland, you have to go back a lot further, all the way back to the middle of the last century.
The ideal Ireland that we would have, the Ireland that we dreamed of a people who, satisfied with frugal comfort, devoted their leisure to the things of the spirit, with the romping of sturdy children, the contest of athletic youth, and the laughter of happy maidens.
This is a story of how an inventive adolescent recreated frugal comforts to become the first person to surf a wave, not just in Ireland, but in Europe. He defied the conformity of the era and anticipated a country's eventual opening to the world. For the first time on radio, Ireland's first surfer reveals what he used to make his surfboard.
Teach us floorboards, 2 big long floorboards to get the longitudinals, and more wardrobes and chest of drawers to get the cross pieces for to make the skeleton, and then laminated top and bottom with ply and plenty of heavy paint on it to waterproof it.
And he tells us the reaction it provoked.
People lined the beach, they didn't know what was coming in. I could see the whites of their eyes before they realised that this thing had length to it.
This guy came out of nowhere. How did he even dream up this board? And, he paddled it out to sea. He was like an apparition, you know, if you can imagine 1949, 1950. You know, you're standing on a beach and you see this guy standing on a board with a paddle. In the history of surfing, it's a big event.
And it was just one chapter in a pioneering life of drawing on his imagination to defy scarcity and realise his ambitions. The Irish Surfing Association estimates that Ireland is home to about 50,000 surfers. Today, surfing is a trendy sport and it's available to everyone.
It's definitely a popular pastime, and everybody knows about surfing.
But when a few hardy enthusiasts began surfing in Ireland in the mid-1960s, things were very different.
When, you know, Hugh O'Brien Moran started surfing, or Henry Moore, or Danny Moore, any of these guys are the Britons, you know, of course, Kevin Cavey and the guys from East Coast Surf Club, Surf Club of Ireland, which it was called at the time, when they started surfing, you know, there was nobody doing it. They didn't know what to do. So, I mean, for anybody to take it up now, or for when I took it up, it was like, you know, you knew where to go, you knew where to paddle, you knew where to surf. These guys didn't know, they were just doing it blind. So it was like a, you know, subculture type thing going on, and everybody was suspicious of these people out in the water. Like, what are they at, you know? You were on the fringes of society, in a sense, you know, if you were a surfer, like, you weren't playing GAA, trust me, you know. Whereas nowadays, you know, I mean, you live in Tremor, or you live in Bundoran or Osnella or Linge, you know, you have as much chance of picking up a surfboard as you do a hurley, a football or whatever. That's kind of how mainstream it is.
Surfing has exploded and fragmented in Ireland. You can now body surf, wind surf, kite surf, body board, knee board or paddle board. Since the noughties, Irish and international surfers have mastered 10-metre-high waves at the Cliffs of Moher in County Clare and at Mullaghmore in County Sligo. Photos of these toe-in surfers garner attention across the globe.
We've got this wetsuit, which actually sells a lot online. That's 124. That's our cheapest winter suit. But
the best-known toe-in or big-wave surfer in Ireland is Richie Fitzgerald. He's been described as the face of Irish surfing, and he owns Surfworld in Bundoran.
Summers are 3.2, these are 5.3, so they're only 2 mil different, but it's actually how it suits.
He tells me what makes Ireland an ideal surfing destination.
It's our natural amenity. It's world class, absolutely world class. Like, we don't have the Amazon River, we don't have the Alps, but we've got surf that's second to none. You know, and that is because we have a conveyor belt of low pressures. I mean, the North Atlantic's a very unstable, stormy stretch of ocean that equates into swell. We've got a serrated coastline that's a mix of limestone and every kind of rock formation, beaches, points, coves, reefs. And it's, you know, it's an old coast, so it's been well hammered by, you know, eons of heavy swell. So there's some fantastic setups, especially along this northwest coast and the Clare coastline. I guess North Sligo as well would be kind of the key points or the key surfing areas. And it really is a world-class surfing destination. So I've traveled the world as a professional surfer and as contests, and I've never ever seen a stretch of coast like the west coast of Ireland with that intense kind of amount of world-class waves packed together in such a small amount of coast. You don't have to listen to me say it. I mean, we've had some of the world's best travel journalists, surf journalists, come from South Africa, Southern California, Australia, Hawaii, everywhere. And, you know, they call it the key phrases, like the cold water Eden, and it's a cold water paradise.
But who was the first person to surf this cold water paradise? And when did it all begin? Back at Port Magee, I asked some of the passengers on Joe's boat if they know when Ireland's first surfer stepped on a board.
Let's see, maybe, 1950s?
Well, maybe, probably back in the 60s he was on the surfboard.
Maybe 200 years ago?
I mean, that's probably a good guess, but I wouldn't say that long ago, but I don't know.
For Joe Roddy, my Skellig's boatman, the sea has been the soundtrack to his life.
My father was a lighthouse keeper. Lighthouse keepers moved from lighthouse to lighthouse, different lighthouses around the coast. They never stayed put in any one place. And I was born in Roach's Point in Cork, in Cove. So after 6 months, he was shifted up to Ballycotton, just not far from Middleton. And we were there for maybe 18 months or 2 years. And we went to Clifton. And there was a convent in Clifton, and that's where I started school. And never liked it. Broke a window in the shed one day, and I was surrounded by penguins. God, I was petrified. And of course, my father had to replace the pane of glass, but I was left standing in the corner for the rest of the day. And then time passed again, and we moved down to Valencia.
Valencia Island ferries. Please observe the position of life raft and life jackets. In the unlikely event of an emergency, follow the instructions of the deck supervisor. Enjoy your trip.
Joe lived in Knightstown on Valentia Island in County Kerry for nearly 5 years while his father was stationed on Antirrhacht, the most westerly of the Blasket Islands. We're at the lighthouse on Valentia Island. It's similar to the one Joe's father was stationed on. Joe is showing me around.
Well, this is an Alvis lamp. You can use it for morsing. And you can morse quite a distance with it. And there's only a tiny little light inside, but the reflector is concave, which concentrates the light into a very narrow beam. We had the type of one that you see on warships. And of course, to contact the Tirith from the dwelling houses inside in Knightstown, there would be a set time every evening when the keeper that was ashore would march out to the Tirith and give them whatever news that was on at the time, and take the list of groceries that the keepers outside wanted for the next relief. Or if there was any messages from headquarters, it was all sent by Morse. They did have a radio, all right, but it was laborsome to have to go over and start an engine and start transmitting. And they'd only use them in an emergency.
Joe tells me about growing up here in the 1940s.
Well, it was totally different to what life is now, because in the summertime, I think we must have been, or my generation must have been, the last of the children going to school barefooted. And the reason was, the shoes we wore, there was no runners, and they were very heavy, and there were heavy studs put on them, and the heel of them, it was like a donkey's shoe at the back of them, and the children really couldn't play with them. So when the warm weather came off, we threw them off, and we went around for the whole summer then barefooted. Everything was different. There was, on Valentia Island, there was, I think, a doctor had a car, the priest had a car, and then there was no tarmac at them roads, so it was all either horse traps or donkeys with traps. And it was a great community spirit there. Everybody was neighbourly in those days. Nowadays, you wouldn't know what's going on next door, and you probably wouldn't want to know what was going on, but everybody knew everybody. And if you were walking around the island, or if I was back of the island, they called it there, plenty of people would give me a cup of tea.
Joe tells me about the games they played.
Well, we didn't have, like, footballs. At that age, it was. I was about 12 before I think I kicked the football, because we just couldn't afford it, and we used to get a pig's bladder and blow that up, and it was always rugby. The half of the street would be playing against the other half of the street, and it was chaos, but I don't know which side I ever won, because it was unreal altogether. There was no toys or anything for children in those days. And
that was a luxury that didn't come in for, I suppose, the next generation.
If Joe wanted something, he soon learned that he'd have to make it himself.
I was very lucky because I was born with what I often referred to as a good pair of hands. And I had no problem with tools because my father had a great set of carpenter's tools. Every lighthouse had carpenter's tools and mechanic tools because they had to maintain the lighthouses and they had to have tools for that.
Right from the start, Joe was improvising.
I was always doing something, making something or other. When I was 6 years of age, I made a fountain pen. And I got just a little thin bamboo cane, shaped it, packed it with cotton wool, and put in a fountain pen nib and a little wedge to hold it in place with a track at the back of the wedge so that the ink could flow. And then put a plug at the other end. It was a primitive fountain pen, but it was fascinating because I didn't have to be dipping into an inkwell. Mm-hmm. But I was always making something or other. So that was my genetic makeup.
Back at Port Magee, the passengers on Joe's boat are getting ready for the crossing to the Skelligs.
And if you've any leather bags, you could put the leather bags in the wheat house in there because you don't want to get salt splashes on them.
Mary, I'm thinking that I won't need my extra jumper.
In there because you don't want to get salt splashes on them. Well, there's a few trousers there, put them on.
Bye bye, dear, be good.
In 1943, when Joe was 8 years old, his family moved again, this time to Dundalk, when his father was transferred to the Pyle Lighthouse. Soon Joe was building a new toy.
I had a good knowledge of wicker work with Sally rods from seeing the fishermen making lobster pots and baskets and things. So I wound up making a canoe. It was about 10 feet long with sally rods, and they were all like tied together like bow and arrows until the frame was strong enough and the gunnels were on it to that it would, when I could cut the strings. That was my mother gave me an old blind, one of those blinds you pull down, and I sheeted it with that, put tar on it. And of course, now I had a canoe, but we couldn't wait until the tar would dry. Three or four of us brought this down to the lake, launched it, and of course, we had to sit on a bag. There was no seat in it. We sat on a bag of hay in the middle, and we sort of paddled with our hands both sides. And of course, we got tar under our oxes here, and Jesus, sure, it nearly burned us alive. We had to go home then, get butter, and that was the only thing you could get rid of the tar with. So it was very unstable. It was cup-shaped rather than saucer-shaped on the bottom. So I came up with the idea of putting an outrigger on it, and that stabilised it.
But where did Joe get the idea for the canoe?
Oh, you would see all these things in comic books. You'd see them all. Like you'd see the Indians and the Mounties and the Canadian canoes. So you'd see all them in magazines, and you'd see them mostly in comic books.
And the comic books gave Joe other ideas.
Around about, must have been a thing about 12 years of age when I would have seen frogmen, as they were called, in the comic books. And they were mostly what was the World War II, riding the mini subs that were, that would, like a chariot, they would sit on the outside of them. I got the idea of making a pair of flippers, but the only thing I had was an aluminium downpipe, and I split that down the middle. I made a fishtail with it, screwed it onto an old pair of shoes, and I converted a World War II gas mask, took out the filter and put in a block of timber into it, and then put a garden hose into that with a bicycle patch on the inside so that I wasn't breathing back down the pipe.
Joe even sculpted a primitive wetsuit by painting coats of tar onto a pair of long johns. Joe also made an underwater camera case.
I made a steel box with a porthole in front of it, two handles on the side, and the base was removable, but it was held on with butterfly nuts and a rubber gasket. I had a square sight on the top of the box outside that would fall down, and there was crosshairs in that. And when I put it up against the mask, what I could see in that square, the camera at 6 feet, the camera could see the same thing.
Joe's photos are some of the earliest taken in Irish waters.
I was able to photograph seals, and I have one of those photographs at home, just one photograph left of that, taken by that underwater camera.
The last part of Joe's ensemble was a homemade spear gun.
And I managed, using that then with a wooden dowel and some hooks, and straightened out on the front of it and rubber bands, that was my my first spear gun.
The spear gun was the start of Joe's adventures in an ancient method of fishing.
Well, spear fishing is free diving. You take a mouthful of air, lift your flippers high up in the air of the bag, and you ascend down under the water. You swim without any tanks, and then you have to go in and out through the weed and one thing and another, the kelp. And if you can manage to spear a fish, they're well and good.
Spearfishing is rarely practiced in Ireland today, but in the late 1950s, spearfishing was common, and the first national spearfishing championships took place in 1963.
Yeah, I was the Irish champion in 67. The records show that I won every trophy that was in it. I don't know, there was 9 or 10 of them trophies in it. The greatest number of fish, the biggest fish, the heaviest weight of fish, all that sort of thing. I learned the characteristics of the fish. If you went down and you caught a lump of kelp and didn't move, the fish, out of curiosity, would come to see you. And when it turned off, then you let go of the spear and that way you hit your target straight on.
In May 1967, Joe qualified to represent Ireland at the 9th World Spear Fishing Championships. Alongside Mick Moriarty, Bernie Brennan and Fintan Maloney, Joe was part of the first Irish spearfishing team to compete internationally. The event was held in September 1967 in newly communist Cuba.
And we were treated like kings. Only a state could put on the functions that were put on for us. But nobody could talk to you because there's always somebody listening in. The only time that anybody would talk to us about the Bay of Pigs or anything like that would be when we would be down the beach because of fear of repercussions. There was rationing at that time. It was 3 ounces of meat a week. Well, where it wouldn't be worth collecting it. Women had a choice of two dresses. That was the fashion. You picked one or the other. You didn't get a catalogue. When we were leaving the place, all the char ladies that were looking after us, they nearly sent us home naked. They wanted shirts, underwear, everything that we could leave behind the poor unfortunates.
Joe could dive deeper than any of his teammates.
And on one of the practice days that were out, I shot a fish at 60 or 65 feet. And there was a reel on the gun, and as I made my ascent, the fish went down and went into a cave and stuck, and I couldn't get him out. I had to leave the gun fall down to the bottom of the water, and I went up then, and Fintan was covering me. He could see what I was doing. So when I came up, he loaned me his gun, and I took a couple of minutes to get put fresh air into the lungs, and I went down, and I had to get right to the bottom depth, and the fish was inside, and I shot the fish again and pulled it out from the small cave it was in. That dive was, the free dive was 105 feet.
That's the equivalent of 32 metres, or the depth of an 11-storey building and back again. At this depth, Joe's consumption of oxygen decreased and his heartbeat plummeted. The resting pulse of the average heartbeat is about 75 beats a minute.
So you can imagine my heartbeat when I was down 100 feet, and I didn't know it, but my heartbeat was probably down to about maybe 10 or 15 beats a minute.
You're listening to Surfing at the Crossroads on News Talk 106 to 108.
About an hour after leaving Port McGee, we arrive at Skellig-Michael. We're met by a raucous symphony. Skellig-Michael, a UNESCO World Heritage Site, is an island of rock that rises like a Gothic cathedral.
Well, we're looking at the small Skelligs over there. We're on the eastern pier, the eastern landing, what the monks would have used. And what we're looking at is guillemots. You see the little ones over there, the penguins?
Yeah.
They're guillemots, and the other ones, both sides of them, they are kittiwakes. You can hear them calling out their name. And then a bit higher up, we have fulmars. So they all have their own shelving and their own places to nest them. And then as you look at the green patches over and on the way up along, you'll see the puffins, and we'll probably see them on the wall as well, standing there. The bird population is holding up well. The gannets have increased from, originally when I was coming out, there was 23,000 pairs. Now there's just 45,000 pairs on it.
Joe shows me around the island.
There's a tall stone slab standing vertical there. If you look at it, it's called the Wailing Woman. And that would have been one of the stations of the cross. And all the stations would have been marked up along in different natural forms. Mm-hmm. And you could imagine the priest.
When he left school, Joe joined the Lighthouse Service in the UK. You could say it was in his genes. Joe is the fourth and last generation of his family to serve in this rich, now vanished tradition. Joe can trace the family tradition all the way back to the 1850s. Many of his family were lighthouse keepers here on Skellig-Michael.
Well, my grandfather was here. My father was here, and two of my uncles were here on it.
Joe shows me a name carving made by one of his family who was stationed here in the 1920s.
Over here, you're going to come over here, we'll see a few names. PR, that was Peter Roddy, he would have been an uncle of mine.
And a lot of the lighthouse keepers wrote them, and there are different dates on their name carvings.
Joe started coming here in 1965. But back then, bringing passengers to the Skelligs was only part of the appeal.
I started coming here first, before it was illegal to take crayfish. Three of us went down over there at the small Skelligs, the western corner, and we got 43 dozen there in the dive. At that time, they were virtually unfished, and they were everywhere. They were like blackberries. Diving was in its infancy in those days. Oh, I'm coming here for over 50 years. I've landed on the place about 20,000 times. And if they were all in the one boat, she'd have to be a cruise liner to carry them, because there'd be 100,000 in it.
1965. That's when the seeds of a surfing culture were planted in Ireland. But long before that, when he was just 14 years old and living in Dundalk, Joe built Ireland's first surfboard. It was 1949.
I was in the technical school at this stage, you know. So there was a friend of mine, his name was Michael McCourt, and Michael gave me teach us that I sheeted the framework. It was floorboards, two big long floorboards to get the longitudinals, and more wardrobes and chest of drawers to get the cross pieces for to make the skeleton, and then laminated top and bottom with ply and plenty of heavy paint on it to waterproof it.
Dear, aloha, good morgen, bonjour, and of course, good morning. I'd like to welcome you all to the last day of Dooley's Winter League. And of course, I'd like to wish you all a happy International Surfing Day.
I'm at the Tibay Surf Centre in Tramore. Formed in 1967, Tibay is one of the oldest surf clubs in the country, and today it's the largest. It's also home to the Irish Surfing Hall of Fame.
Let's come over here for a minute in a kind of a semicircle. Just come over this way. We all know what we're at, all right? This is like week 8. This is probably like year 2 or 3 for some of you. So it's high tide. We're staying straight opposite Tibay. Straight opposite.
Yeah, well, we decided probably about 7 or 8 years ago to draw up a few people we wanted to really just commemorate and just give them, you know, their place, their rightful place in the history of surfing.
Martin Cullinan from the Tibay Surf Centre. He tells me about the night Joe was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2009. 60 years after he built Ireland's first surfboard.
It was a crazy enough night. It was a great night in Irish surfing. We had all the clubs represented from you know, Rosneala all the way down the West Coast. And Joe was our first inductee. And the night itself kicked off. We just introduced Joe. We told his story through photos on the wall. And we had a storyline to go along with it. For about 20 minutes. So it gave everybody a sense of what Joe had done. They knew Joe by the end of it. And he got a standing ovation, and he presented us then with the Joe Roddy trophy, which we now present, you know, pretty much every year to our outstanding athlete.
That morning, Joe went surfing.
He arrived here and we had a surf class in the morning. We had some of our kids surfing in the morning. So they all got introduced to Joe. And it was great for the kids that, you know, they were meeting this guy that, you know, predated any of their parents, or probably, you know, grandparents almost.
I've travelled with Joe from his home in Killorglan, County Kerry, to the Tibay Surf Centre here in Tramore.
Hello,
Joe, great to see you. How are you?
I'm good.
You're looking well.
And yourself?
Good, good. Great to see you back in Tibay again.
Yeah, that's good. I see you kept the tummy well down anyway.
I'm fighting fit, Joe. I heard you were coming. I said I better start working out in case you put me through my paces. Joe, there she is.
Yes.
Look at her in all her glory. Oh, yeah.
When Joe was inducted into the Hall of Fame, he built two replicas of his 1949 surfboard. One for the sea and one for display.
But it's still a great talking point, Joe, when anyone ever comes into the centre. You know, they come up the stairs here, in the middle of the tea bay here, and that's the first thing they see. Yeah, and they always come up. People brush past it, reach out, touch it.
Yeah.
We have our little biography of you there on the board, so they stop.
Yeah.
They read about it. They often ask us what it's all about, and you know, we give them the whole story of it. And the fact that it's hanging up here, it's a great piece of history to have hanging in tea bay.
Well, we're looking at a very long surfboard. It must be something I don't remember the measurements, but it's probably about 14 feet long, about 2 feet wide. And it's made up of panels, as we see here. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 panels. And the last three panels are not fitted in there so that children can come to the surf center here in Tramore and they can see how the board was made. And the skeleton is two long floorboards, and they're kept apart by a brace across, and then the whole shape was worked on, and then all the bridging pieces under each panel, they were all chest of drawers.
I asked some of the young surfers at Tea Bay what they know about the start of surfing in Ireland.
I think it was Joe Roddy in 1949, and I think that's where it started in Ireland.
Joe tells me about the reaction his original surfboard created.
But I remember one time I went from Dundalk out to the lighthouse there, the Pile Light as it was called, along the river. And then I came in back to the shoreline halfway between Dundalk and Giles's Quay. There was a beach there, and there was a lot of railway wagons. They were along the beach and they were there. And when I came in from 2 miles at sea, the people lined the beach. They didn't know what was coming in because I had a paddle and I was standing on something that they couldn't see. Sure, it was only about 4 inches thick, mm-hmm. and with me standing on it. And I could see the whites of their eyes before they realized that this thing had length to it. They'd only see the front width of it, about 2 feet broad. It was a big novelty because it was different to a canoe. It couldn't sink. The fishermen were very annoyed with me because I'd be out and when it would be rough. And they used to say, you'll get drowned one of these days and we won't come out for you.
To the people on the beach, it looked like Joe was walking on water.
You know, this guy came out of nowhere. He paddled it out to sea. He was like an apparition, you know, if you can imagine 1949, 1950. You know, you're standing on a beach and you see this guy standing on a board with a paddle.
You were telling me, Joe, the your inspiration for the surfboard. Do you remember where it came from? But you must have seen a photo.
Well, I must have seen, it could be a photo in a magazine. It could have been on some form of a newsreel and a picture or something. But somewhere I would have seen that because it's too realistic to what they were using at that time, the big boards in Hawaii.
I think that you said that it was, you saw an old Reader's Digest magazine.
That's possible, but I suppose the only way, you'll have to bring me to a hypnotist and see can they go back in time. Because the subconscious mind would still have a lot of information in it. But and the silver years have taken away a lot of the memory. So I can't really be precise. So it could be any of those things. But it certainly wasn't on a beach anywhere.
Surfing would have started in Ireland.
I know the general idea, but I don't know what year, like, this. The surfboard from the first surfer is up in T-Bay, and it was like, I think a fellow went to Hawaii and went back to Ireland in like 1916 or something. No, was it 1916? That's all I know.
Maybe 1940s by Joe Roddy. I met him, he came here a few years ago, and he's still surfing, and he's such an old age, but it's so good to see.
Your place in Irish surfing is there for forevermore. Yeah. As you know, Ireland's first, and more so than surfing, developing the first board, actually shaping the first board. You know, I mean, we would always have to credit the likes of Kevin Cavey for developing the sport and for traveling the country with a surfboard and bringing surfing to all parts of the country. You know, we're just delighted, Joe's story, because it predated really what we all thought was the first surfer. So we were just delighted that the story wasn't lost to history.
And Joe's story would have been lost to history if it wasn't for a photograph taken of Joe with his surfboard.
But the photograph really that I marvel at, because it was only about the size of a packet of 10 cigarettes.
Joe has a black and white photograph of his original surfboard. Taken in the early 1950s, it shows Joe, dressed in a suit, standing proudly beside his homemade contraption. Joe is dwarfed by his 14-foot or 4-metre surfboard. On one of the T-chests that Joe used to manufacture the board, you can see the words, product of Sri Lanka.
And I managed to keep it all those years.
Yeah.
And so, because otherwise, if that was lost, everything would be hearsay.
That's your proof.
Yeah, that was the proof of it, yeah.
Hawaiian Duke Kahanamoku is regarded as the first person to popularize surfing.
When the Duke was 67, I started surfing. And I find that more incredible than being the first surfer in Ireland, that I actually surfed while that man was still alive.
A famous photo of the Duke shows him standing beside his surfboard on a Los Angeles beach in 1920.
There is a great similarity in the two boards. Mine is slightly more pointed at the stern than his one. Other than that, they're virtual copies of each other. In those days, I would never have seen that photograph of the Duke. If I had, I would have made my board a carbon copy of his, but I didn't. And it looks like he had all one piece of timber or plywood for the whole length of it. Well, mine was like a patchwork quilt.
I mean, to say you were ahead of your time is an understatement.
Well, it never registered very much, but on days like today, it does. Because it all comes back to you. But when you do these things, you never really see what the pioneering breakthroughs that you're doing, like, you know.
And the Joe Roddy Perpetual Trophy will be given out to the most improved, dedicated surfer over the last 12 months at T-Bay. And for those of you that don't know Joe Roddy, he was the first man to surf a wave in 1949 here in Ireland. I'd like to present this to Mr. Tom Breen.
After Joe's perpetual trophy is presented, he meets with the winner, Tom Breen.
Keep up the surfing now, Tom.
What age are you now?
12.
Yeah, well, I would have been about 2 years older than you when I made that board there, the replica board of the original one.
Joe and Tom have met before.
Did you get to surf on the blue one?
Yeah, with you a couple of years ago.
Oh, you were, I remember you now in the photograph.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Apart from this trophy in Tremor, two other trophies bear Joe's name. One is in the Board Riders Surf Club in Bundoran. The other is further afield.
The Basque area, northern Spain there, he has one. He came to me.
because they tried to check around Europe and they could not find a surfer before my time. So that accounts for the third one.
Joe isn't just the first surfer in Ireland, he's the first surfer in Europe.
Joe surfed, he made this board and he surfed and then he went on to other things. You know, he did a lot of things in his life. He has his place as the guy who really, you know, started it all off before anybody was doing it. You know, a lot of guys in the 60s would have seen stuff in California. Joe didn't know what was going on in California. And, you know, just made it out of, you know, with his bare hands. And, you know, as a craftsman, he put it together and you know, paddled it and surfed it, you know, and then moved on.
It's early afternoon when we return to Port McGee from the Skelligs. Two of the passengers, Ricardo and Cynthia, approach Joe.
You were one of the first surfers of Ireland. Can I get a picture with you?
You can, of course, yeah. You can have my photograph. I know. Yes. So, are you a surfer yourself?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where do you surf?
I'm surfing Brazil.
Brazil.
Oh, Brazil. Oh, God. You're a long way from home.
Oh, yeah. Just came to meet you. Oh,
for more than 50 years, Joe Roddy has ferried over 20,000 passengers to and from the Skelligs. What most of these passengers never knew was that their boatman was the first surfer in Ireland and in Europe. Long before the flame of the 1960s surf culture was lit, a pioneering adolescent crafted a makeshift board and, in the tradition of ancient Hawaiian kings, took to the sea.
Do you remember when we met? That's the day I knew you were my pet. I want to tell you how much I love you.
Surfing at the Crossroads was produced by Brendan Daly and was supported by a grant from the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland as part of the Sound and Vision Scheme. To listen back to this or any other Newstalk documentary, go to newstalk.com/documentary on Newstalk.